Hello and welcome to this podcast with Media News. I'm Matt Broomfield. This is the first in a series of podcasts that I'll be recording for Media News, our news site covering current affairs in and about Kurdistan. And I'm very excited to discuss with international friends, supporters, colleagues, comrades, and people with an involvement or an interest in or relation to the Kurdish issue, and to look at these issues in a global perspective. I'm speaking to you here from London, and I'm very glad today to be joined by David Adler, who is the General Coordinator of the organisation Progressive International, which we will introduce shortly, but an organisation which unites progressive forces across the globe in many different countries and working towards various goals, many of which align with the goals and with the ideals of the Kurdish freedom movement as well, and an organisation which has stood alongside the Kurdish freedom movement since its foundation several years ago. So, David, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thanks so much, Matt.
And yeah, just to begin with, maybe you could explain to our listeners what is Progressive International, when and why was it founded, and what's your role in the organisation?
So about 5 years ago, we could see the formation and the increasing capacity for coordination among a new cohort of, some would say, neo-fascist, right populist forces that range from the president in my country of origin, Donald Trump, to the Trump of the tropics, Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, to allies like Erdogan. And if you want to continue the alliance that would reach all the way to Modi in India and Duterte in the Philippines, committed to a kind of politics of repression on the one hand, of minorities, of women, of socialists and communists and anyone who identifies their political ideology on the one hand, and accumulation of vast wealth through looting, extraction, and other forms of exploitation of people and planet towards the strengthening of a certain elite of political leaders, their friends, and their family. So it was in that moment that we saw the rise of a reactionary international, that many of us around the world saw the need for a counter movement to defend those democratic, progressive, socialist values by forming a progressive international that could bind together not just the political parties of the world. Over the last century and a half, we've seen the formation of many internationals. First, the second, the fourth and a half, various internationals. But those were all a very specific kind of organizational form that was particularly focused on the political party. And here in the 21st century, I think we can see that there's much more diversity in our associational and political lives. And that means that there's a role for political parties, of course, fundamental. There's a role for social movements, people's movements around the world that are organizing at the most grassroots level, at the front lines of a lot of the most violent and extraction and dispossessive tendencies of capital and our political systems, as well as the trade unions, who for far too long have been kept at the margin of the story of so-called progressive politics, all the way to research centers producing important research and intellectual thought and publications, taking seriously the role that information, mediatic warfare plays in the production of politics and the negotiation that we all have about the terrain on which we are fighting. So it was about bringing together this quite vast coalition, not only vast, as I said, in terms of its geography, with the ambition to be a true international operating at global scale, but also ambition in its vast coalition across sectors and organizational forms. So it was from there that we sort of got to work building out the actual institutional form of what this international, the 21st century, was going to be.
Maybe you could mention a bit, so as you mentioned, there are kind of various types of organizations. If you could quickly sketch, you know, which parts of the world are we talking about and what type of organizations is this? Political parties, trade unions, other social movements?
Yeah. So I think when the organization was first starting out with such a radical proposal about building this international for the 21st century, it was natural that the initial energies were in parts of the world where that tradition of left internationalism is a living tradition. So in Latin America, for example, the Progressive International Council, among its members, the largest trade unions in the region, like the CUT in Brazil, that represents millions of workers across sectors of Brazil, counts among its members the governing parties of Chile, of Colombia, and Honduras, as we've seen these new generation of progressive leaders come to power just in the past year alone, right? And includes critical social movements like homeless workers movement, like the People's Congress in Colombia, who are really bringing together farmers with urban workers to try to lead, you know, national strikes and mobilizations against repression and exploitation. But there's another part of the world where internationalism is also a very living tradition. That is, of course, in Kurdistan and in Turkey, where for many years we've had the opportunity to collaborate with the People's Democratic Party in particular, for whom internationalism is just a foundational, fundamental value that informs all aspects of the work. And you introduced the segment by thinking about, you know, how there's an alignment in the values of this progressive international, be they anti-capitalist, anti-authoritarian, or ecological and feminist, with the values of the Kurdish freedom movement. And I think it's, you know, from the very beginning, been a very powerful alliance that we've been able to build across Turkey and beyond, with parts of that Kurdish freedom movement who are very much committed to those same values in advancing a kind of internationalism that accepts its basis. The struggle of one is a struggle of all. And I think that it's very easy to see from Kurdistan why internationalism is not a luxury, you know, but it's a necessity, why it's a strategy for survival as opposed to just kind of charitable impulse. So we'll get more into what those initiatives, shared initiatives, have looked like. But what's been great about working with the Kurdish freedom movement in general is the way in which that solidarity does come so naturally. So whenever we're working in continent of Africa and South Asia and across Latin America, it is always that movement first and foremost that lends its solidarity and is prepared to kind of mobilize in defense of the principles that it holds dear in its own region.
Indeed. I think those kind of any peoples that lack, for whatever reason, a state of their own are often particularly reliant on and understanding of, as you say, the need for internationalism, because it comes naturally when you're denied protections that are offered to other peoples, and so you seek those protections and build those protections whatever way you can. When we speak about internationalism now, you mentioned obviously the previous internationals across the past century and a half. What's different then about the type of internationalism that Progressive International is trying to build? How do you do that, and how have you sought to do that together with your partners in Kurdistan?
Yeah, I think when it comes to the definition of internationalism, I think it's safe to say that we've kind of lost the plot. I mean, I think when you go really back into the story of what internationalism is and was, this was a theory of a really developed, coherent, and profound theory of common and simultaneous action. That was, of course, at that time, speaking in terms of the 19th century context, a purely revolutionary concept. That revolution in one country was going to then enable revolutions in other countries, such that there was a cascading effect of workers and ordinary peoples rising up against these repressive and extractive regimes to reclaim power. And that's the theory of kind of global revolution that underpinned a certain theory of internationalism that required coordinated simultaneous action. I think in the intervening century, and especially the late 20th century in particular, we kind of lost the plot on that question of what solidarity is and isn't, what internationalism is for. And it became a rhetorical expression, a way of sort of writing declarations and saying you stand in solidarity with something without any actual substance behind that, any real conviction or program stood behind it. So we are trying to revive that concept of solidarity and give more substance to the definition of internationalism. And so that means really trying to identify the pressure points in our international political system there that we can press to deliver the kind of transformation we're looking for. That's very vague, but I think that our theory of internationalism really does move in two different directions. In one direction, it moves from the global to the local. So let's take the example of repression of Kurds in Turkey. Last year, I led a delegation to the outskirts of Ankara to the so-called Kobani case, when so many members of the People's Democratic Party were being tried for thousands of years in prison, including the co-chair of the HTV, Thomas Tash, who's been tried for 10,000 years in prison over a series of social media posts that the regime, the Erdogan regime, had deemed to be a form of terrorism. And so these are clearly gestures of repression that in the case of the Kobani case, someone like Erdogan would want to keep, you know, outside of international view, kind of, you know, so you could even tell from where the case was happening and the ways in which there was kind of desire to keep it in its corner, that we try to bring global solidarities to bear on these more local struggles and create more space for maneuver for progressive forces who are feeling very threatened and afraid and kind of challenged by the regime, to try to say, you know, we're with you, and you know, we're going to mobilize in our own areas, in our own geographies, in our own sectors, to try to make sure that, you know, we're holding that regime accountable. In that sense, there's also, you know, the local to the global. So that's where we are building coalitions that can actually transform international architecture at the global level. So in some cases, it's about like vaccines. Vaccines are a global issue. We can't do the global to the local thing alone. So we'll go out and build a union for vaccine internationalism that can bring together everyone from the Carolinians to the Kenyans to the Cubans to the Mexicans to try to think about how we can, in front of the failure of the WTO and institutions like COVAX that were designed to deliver vaccines to everyone, how can we build our own institutions to ensure the production distribution of vaccines to everyone? Or it can mean talking about NATO, right? Breaking out of a conversation around NATO as being a defensive alliance that is the last bulwark for democracy in a world of increasing autocracy, to say, no, we're actually going to build an international coalition in defense of Kurdish peoples, right? And this was what our more recent peace delegation to Iraqi Kurdistan was all about, to say, you know, the NATO issue, even in the context of this inflamed war in Ukraine, needs to be understood from a Kurdish perspective, or it's not understood at all. Right? Because seen from that perspective reveals, shed lights on what's the true enduring nature of this military alliance that has, you know, overseen so much destruction, violence, massacre, and damage, you know, not just within its own borders, but of course beyond them in countries like Libya, Afghanistan, and beyond. So I think when it comes to what our definition of internationalism, it's very much how can we, you know, mobilize in our respective parliaments, on our respective streets, in our respective workplaces, to try to create more room for maneuver for the Kurdish people, to say, okay, these people are at our backs, and that gives us some strength, some confidence, but also to partner with the Kurdish freedom movement to challenge global institutions that either enable or prohibit the expression of democratic progressive values in all parts of the world.
Indeed. Yeah, I mean, I think it's almost quite a sort of a delicate balancing act sometimes, insofar as it's a truth and a reality in our world that there are hegemonic powers, particularly, but not only in the West, that are very important and very dominant in Kurdistan and the Middle East and elsewhere in the world. And, you know, that needs to be acknowledged. But at the same time, one can then arrive to a kind of warped internationalism, which is about, can we win influence? Can we win power? Can we get particularly the USA to do X, Y, and Z? Can we get Western powers to do X, Y, and Z? Or can we get other global powers to do X, Y, and Z? But it sounds like what you're trying to do with your organization is also to look at kind of sources of power that can have an influence and an impact, even though they're coming from countries outside the Western core and kind of outside imperial powers.
Yeah, I mean, our ambition is very much to deliver a new institutional order in the world. So we take a lot of inspiration from that incredible moment now coming up on 50 years ago, when the nations of the third world, having won their independence, secured a, you know, new vision that was introduced in the UN General Assembly for a new international economic order that was going to be driving us towards a vision of sovereign democratic development, and the kind of non-aligned movement that was born of that moment in time, to say, you know, we're actually these nations, these peoples, these communities are demanding their own rights to a kind of self-determined trajectory of development and political formation. And I think, you know, in a world of increasing great power competition, it's precisely that vision that we hope to recuperate, that we're moving into a more multipolar world, that multipolarity can either lead to more violence, more repression, more proxy conflict, or it can be a world that gives more space to peoples and nations across the world to develop in their own ways, to not live under the thumb of various imperial pressures. And of course, I think, you know, once again, speaking about these questions of non-alignment, of new international economic orders, it's once again to the Kurdish Freedom Movement that we look not only for intellectual inspiration, for thinking through, you know, what are new models of political design, you know, in terms of how we can kind of transcend a lot of the institutional failures and rigid institutional forms of so-called democratic countries. But also it's a place where we can see how the kind of competing powers, serve to limit the expression of self-determination by the Kurdish people as opposed to enable it. And so that's where the urgency of that kind of project becomes clear.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I think, something that you see very clearly in Kurdistan is the possibility to operate in the kind of fractures and in the gaps between the hegemonic powers in the world. And it's been something I've kind of been wondering about lately is with, you know, kind of the ongoing end of the end of history, but, you know, and the reemergence of, or the kind of the strengthening and the deepening of great power conflict in the world once again, whether this, this idea of, you know, a third worldist movement that was, you know, being led decades ago by, whether by the former Yugoslavia or originally by Indonesia or by Egypt or other countries, can actually become a kind of force on the world stage, which rejects, you know, their kind of what is now not even kind of two competing political systems, but two in their own way different kind of oligarchic capitalist systems, and really advocate for an alternative. But at the same time, it's not a project that was completely successful by any stretch of the imagination 50 years ago. And now many of the countries that took a lead in that project have kind of, you know, aligned themselves one way or the other. Do you think that the kind of increasing tensions in the world between Russia and America and between China will create space for alternatives to develop? Is that something you've seen in Kurdistan or elsewhere?
Yeah, my sense is that we're really at a geopolitical crossroads here. And why I think that there's a lot of urgency in that project of non-alignment or the construction of a new NIEO, so to speak, which is that the second Cold War is now very much underway. I don't think we should be naive about the start date of that new Cold War. I think it's begun. And as in the original Cold War, you know, there's always a chance for proxy conflict, for huge parts of the world to be considered basically sacrifice zones for those or chess pieces, those great powers to compete and to challenge each other. Or we can really set about building the institutions and driving forward a vision that can actually guarantee that the increasing multipolarity of the world, or the decline of the total global domination of the United States, does create some more room. Now, I think in Latin America, where I do a lot of work and from where I'm speaking to you now, that is a sort of simpler task, in large part because, you know, this region really is facing off against a single great power, for the most part, who claims natural right to dominate its own hemisphere. Whereas in Kurdistan, it's such a layered conflict, and there's so many
different... Everybody's right to dominate.
Yeah, and there's so many different challenges to sovereignty that come in the form of these various powers competing for territory, competing for resources, and competing for domestic political power by using the Kurds as, you know, bogeyman for their respective causes. So, you know, it's in Kurdistan that we see precisely the urgency of the latter project, which is to say, if we don't move quickly to try to instantiate a new international order, a new institutional arrangement that is in greater respect for sovereignty, in greater respect for democracy in all parts of the world, then we are more likely to see the dark side of multipolarity. We're more likely to see the dark side, which is horse trading, which is riding roughshod over those people's desires and dreams and democratic will to, you know, reinstantiate kind of more realist power in those parts of the world.
Yeah, I think your mention of the dark side of multipolarity brings us quite neatly, I think, to the current Turkish government and to President Erdogan. And I wanted to come back a bit to what you mentioned at the beginning about a kind of rising fascism in the world, and you know, the kind of commonalities between the Trumps, the Bolsonaros, and other right-wing populist strongmen, however you want to phrase it. How do you see the current Turkish government fitting into this increasing multipolar conflict? Where do they stand? What's Erdogan's game, and how can progressives oppose that?
I mean, in my opinion, Erdogan has played his cards quite effectively with respect to the NATO conflict, and understood that the effort by the Atlanticists to instantiate and expand NATO as the primary instrument of confrontation with Russia provided a huge opportunity for Erdogan to sort of get back in the good graces of the West, in much the same way that he recognized the political opportunity presented by the 2015 so-called migrant crisis and the influx of Syrians to Europe to try to, you know, again play cards with Germany and the European Union more broadly. So this is a person who is very keenly aware of the geopolitical position that Turkey has, where it sits in between Europe and the Middle East, and how it can balance between its relationships between the Russians, Chinese, and the West. So I think Erdogan is a really important person and really important kind of cipher for this multipolar moment, and not just for the multipolar moment geopolitically at an international level, but the relationship between sort of multipolar geopolitics and domestic democratic contestation. So you ask, well, what can progressive forces do? I mean, I think we have to, and I don't want to lecture anybody here, but if we're speaking to the Turkish side, like, we have to defend whatever we can of the integrity, the transparency, the validity of the elections that are coming, which are a very potent and legitimate, if executed well, vehicle for the eviction of the AKP from power. And of course, I, like most of my friends in Turkey, are deeply afraid of what could be coming down the path this year, as Erdogan hopes to cling to the power that he's instantiated in his person and his family. But I do think that the electoral contest remains in a world where democratic legitimacy is the most recognizable form of political legitimacy that we know, that we have to cling to that and mobilize as we can to hold internationally, hold everyone to account, to the promise of, you know, what is left of Turkish democracy, as well as to, you know, really use it as an opportunity to wedge in a new vision for what a more democratic and plurinational Turkey might look like.
Absolutely. And then I suppose kind of the flip side of that question would be, yeah, on one side, as you've illustrated, both in the upcoming Turkish elections next year and more broadly, there's an importance for the international community insofar as it can stand alongside and support the Kurdish political movement in its various manifestations. Are there things that the internationalist left can learn from the Kurdish movement, maybe things that you've observed during your own time in Kurdistan or more broadly?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is something that I hope that our organization can play a role in. And, you know, we see now, as we've seen before, this kind of the multiplication of various Kurdish institutes, centers, and academies for thinking through the political philosophy that has been developed and matured through the Kurdish freedom movement. I think that there's a huge role precisely in what I was saying before, right? If we're going to embark on this ambitious process of geopolitical transformation at the international level, and thinking through these questions of what democracy is and isn't. I mean, you know, if you take the liberal discourse in my country of origin around crisis of democracy, about the erosion of democratic norms and values, you need to also take seriously potential prescriptions that are not just, you know, better like civic education in public schools or like some light taxation of like yachts, but has to be a much more fundamental reorientation of our political systems. And I think that the Kurds have so much to teach us about that. And I think that's really where it comes to be the obligation of the international left to defend the Rojava revolution on the eve of its 10th anniversary with such an imminent threat posed by the invading forces, Erdogan, that this is not just about it is, of course, about self-determination, sovereignty, and defending the Kurdish people from vicious violence and repression. But it's also about defending a project that has given the world a kind of shining example of real novel, transformational, feminist and egalitarian model of political orientation, political kind of foundation, that I think is something from which we all need to learn. Because, of course, in this world, as you put it, Matt, with sort of these hegemonic powers and hegemonic models, I think there's a case to be made that that new kind of right populist model is itself becoming a kind of hegemonic model that people in huge parts of the world no longer see as, they don't see alternative to this highly unequal and highly repressive governing structure. There's a case to be made that even we're talking about the Tories in the UK, or even some of the Democrats in the United States, are still playing that same game, talking cheap and well playing to them. So anyway, the point is that, there is so much that's worth defending, and it's so many ways in which all of our countries, whether it's those of our countries that are in NATO, are so complicit in this whole process. And I think it's incumbent upon everyone, even the sort of liberal Democrats all the way to the furthest reaches of the left, to stand with the Kurdish people. It's a really difficult moment, but also a really promising moment for changing the political configuration of Turkey in a way that can guarantee the safety, security, and prosperity of the Kurdish people.
Absolutely, yeah. And yeah, this kind of this spirit of learning from one another and from different movements is certainly something that I've observed in my own time in Kurdistan and meeting with the Kurdish movement. And it's, it's great to have this conversation, which, is of just a small part of this broader conversation occurring all across the globe. But I think, we can bring it to a close there. On that note, I wondered if there was just any kind of closing thoughts that you would like to share about any of the subjects we've discussed today, anything you think we've missed, which is important to highlight in the context of Kurdistan as it stands today and the threats that the Kurdish freedom movement faces today.
Not at all. Only to say that I hope that you who are listening to this program does join us. We are a coalition that is constantly growing and constantly trying to deliver on our mission to make solidarity more than a slogan, and find us at progressive.international. And I hope that you get in touch.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, David, for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me, Matt.
Thank you. And we look forward to all of the listeners as well joining us next time for our next podcast here on Medianews. Thanks again to David Adler and to Progressive International. Goodbye.